Welcome to the Accenture MIT podcast series. Here's Daniel Jackson, professor of computer science at MIT.
The leaking of American diplomatic cables was the big news story as 2010 came to a close. There was a lot of discussion about the content of the cables, what they say about American foreign policy, about governments and politicians in other countries discussed in the cables, and what the consequences of their publication will be. What's hardly been discussed at all, though, is how such a massive leak could occur. Chances are we'll never really know, at least not until 25 years has passed and the documents of the current administration are made public under the Freedom of Information Act. But we can put together some of the story by joining the dots, connecting a few of the very partial sources of information that we have. As you'll see, the story that emerges puts American military security in quite a bad light and reminds us of some fundamental security issues that apply to all of us. We're all owners of our own personal data and are increasingly concerned about how vulnerable our data is to being compromised, whether it's our basic personal information, which if it falls into criminal hands, might allow someone to steal our identity, our financial data, which might allow someone to break into our bank accounts, medical data, which might, for example, be used to deny us insurance coverage, or any kind of personal data whose release might cause us embarrassment or loss. Moreover, as software professionals, many of us are responsible for other people's data, either as what are called controllers of the data, that means you actually collect and use the data yourself, or as processors of the data, which means that you process or analyze the data on a client's behalf. The WikiLeaks episode isn't some cloak and dagger spy story with little relevance to our daily lives. It contains lessons that we can put to use every day. Here are some of the elements of the story. But first, a disclaimer. As I said, there's very little information out there in the public about what actually happened. So what I'll tell you is based on what I've read in various online sources and news reports, which include some amount of speculation. It seems that after 9/11, the US government realized that information sharing between the various intelligence agencies was poor, and so they set out to make it easier for agencies to access each other's information. According to the Washington Post, a project called Net-Centric Diplomacy was launched, with the aim of improving the sharing of information by providing a centralized database. Because of the poor design of this system, and because its users were confused about how it worked, this database came to hold vast amounts of State Department cables. Consequently, many U.S. government employees were able to see secret information that had previously been inaccessible to them. Part of this information was those diplomatic cables, reports sent by diplomats back to Washington. These cables were marked secret, which meant that they should only be read by government employees with a level of clearance able to read secret documents, and they were transmitted on the SIPRNet. SIPRNet is a completely separate network used by the US government and military for communicating. It uses the same protocols as the regular internet, but all data transmission is encrypted, and audit mechanisms record accesses to it. This is the network that is used for planning and executing military missions as well. Machines that are connected to SIPRNet have to be in secure locations, and there are no connections between SIPRNet and the regular internet. There's what's called an air gap, which means there's no path along a wire from one to the other, so there's supposedly very little risk of data from SIPRNet making it onto the internet. Typically, people who work with classified information in governments have multiple computers on their desks, each at a different level of classification. One, for example, connected to the regular internet, and one connected to SIPRNet, with no connection between them. The only way to transfer information from the classified computer to the unclassified one is using what's colloquially called SneakerNet, which means physically carrying a data storage device, such as a USB key or a writable disk, from one to the other. And that's not supposed to be possible, since classified machines generally don't have any external ports or drives that allow data to be taken off them except through the secret network. What happened in this case appears to be this. Bradley Manning, a fairly low-level soldier in the US Army, was working as an intelligence analyst at an American base in Iraq. His clearance gave him access to the SIPANET. He apparently had two laptops on his desk, as I've just described. For reasons that aren't clear, it seems that Manning's laptop, the secret one connected to SIPANET, that is, contained a CD drive that was capable of writing CDs. Manning brought in some CDs that he'd previously recorded music on. He'd even gone to the trouble of putting labels on them. One of them apparently looked like a Lady Gaga album, and did actually contain Lady Gaga music, but the CDs were actually CDRWs, which are rewritable, and Manning inserted them into his classified laptop and downloaded the cables onto them. Presumably, he then inserted the same CDs into his other laptop, and was thus able to upload the classified data to a server associated with the WikiLeaks organization. What are the lessons to be learned from this? First, point one, it's now clear in retrospect that making classified data more widely available was very dangerous. It's obviously important for intelligence agencies to be able to share information, but it's a fine balance, and in this case, it looks as if the US government went too far in making data too widely available. There's a principle in security called need to know. It means simply that data shouldn't be accessible by someone unless they really need to know it, even if they have the right level of clearance to access it. This principle is easy to state, but hard to implement. The standard kind of security is called multi-level security. This means that there are different vertical levels, such as unclassified, classified, secret, and top secret, and everyone has a clearance at some level. A typical rule is that you can read anything below your level and can write to anything above it. For example, if you have secret clearance, you can read unclassified and secret documents. You can't read top secret documents, but you can write them, which allows you to create a report for a superior, for example. The need-to-know principle requires a different kind of security, usually called multilateral security, where the groupings are horizontal rather than vertical. One way to implement this is with special code words on top of a multi-level security scheme. For example, there might be a code word associated with Iraq, and if you had secret Iraq clearance, that would mean you could access secret documents with the Iraq keyword. The purpose of the wider distribution of US intelligence, however, was precisely to avoid the inconveniences of this kind of multilateral security scheme. Security always comes at a cost. Just think about the last time you locked yourself out of your house. So it's always a balancing act between the risks of security breaches and the level of inconvenience you're prepared to put up with. And in this case, the motivation for making data more widely available was more than just convenience. It was to allow greater cooperation between intelligence agencies in the hope that they could foil terrorism more effectively. The lesson is clear, though. Aggregating lots of data into a single location and allowing access to many people is very dangerous. The parent company of TJ Maxx and Marshalls, an American chain of discount stores, had a single database containing the credit card information of 45 million customers. This database was penetrated by hackers over a period of 4 years until 2003. This was probably the largest breach of consumer information to date, and was made possible by the fact that all this information was aggregated. Another astonishing example is the loss in England in November 2007 of child benefit claim records for 25 million people. A government employee had put them on a CD unencrypted and sent it in the mail. Not surprisingly, the British public has been uneasy about plans to centralize the storage of health data for all citizens. The point is simple. Aggregating data dramatically increases the cost of a security attack. That's why people who say electronic voting is no worse or no more risky than paper ballot voting, because both are flawed, are missing the point. A buggy or compromised computer system can corrupt thousands of electronic votes, but it's much harder to compromise paper votes. The solution is simple too. It's called compartmentation or compartmentalization, and means just dividing the data into smaller sets that aren't so widely shared. But in practice, it's not easy to balance the costs and benefits, since, as I said, aggregating data, while making it more vulnerable, makes it easier and cheaper to process. So that's point one. The second point is that even in an age of virtual systems, Physical security still matters. If Bradley Manning's laptop had not had a CD drive installed, it would have been much harder for him to transfer the secret data. Physical security is not easy to achieve. In its extreme form, there are devices that self-destruct when tampered with. In electronic voting, it's obviously very important that voters aren't able to tamper with the internal records of the voting machine. But it turned out that a university team was able to overcome the lock on a standard voting machine in minutes and reset the vote counts. Third, however good your technology is, it's always people that matter most. Someone has to set up the technology and maintain it. And because of insider attacks, in which the attacker is someone from within the organization, it's impossible to design a system so that it's completely secure. In fact, it's impossible to make a system secure just against external attacks, too. But internal attacks are much harder to prevent. Insider attacks, by the way, are very common, especially in banking. Ross Anderson, a professor at the University of Cambridge in the UK, who, by the way, has written an encyclopedic and wonderful accessible book on security called Security Engineering, wrote a paper back in 1992 entitled Why Crypto Systems Fail, which includes lots of stories about banking scams. In one, a teller discovered that changing the address of an account wasn't audited, so he changed the address of an account temporarily, long enough to allow him to order a new ATM card and get it mailed to his house so he could draw money out of the account. In a recent blog article, Anderson notes that this same kind of scam is still happening. Anyway, you can protect against insider attacks to some degree, for example by auditing so that every significant action by an employee is logged, but ultimately you have to put some reliance on honesty. In fact, the bigger problem is not dishonest employees but sloppy ones. The reason the person without authorization can get into a secure area is often because someone just lets them in. That's why you see signs in many organizations warning against so-called piggybacking, in which one person uses a card to open a door and then lets other people walk in behind them. In other words, to have good security, you need to have a culture in which everybody is careful and plays by the rules, even when those rules might seem silly. In the WikiLeaks case, it seems that the security culture in the military base was pretty bad. Manning said that although there were 5-digit cipher locks on the doors, visitors would often just knock, and people would let them into the secure area. Manning was worried that he might be caught, in fact. So according to him, he asked the specialist in his unit from the National Security Agency if he had noticed any suspicious activity. The specialist said he didn't bother to look, even though that was presumably his job. Manning also described how many of his colleagues brought music CDs into the secure area with them, and apparently it was easy to get audit logs erased because the system administrators just deleted them rather than copying them when they set machines up. A good security culture can't just be imposed. You need a community that's actually motivated to abide by the cultural norms. It seems that Manning was quite depressed. He claimed to have been treated badly, and the morale in general in his group was very low. A few weeks ago, I was asked by Accenture to complete a short online training course about security and privacy. I expect many of you did it too. The WikiLeaks affair should make us all more appreciative of how important this kind of training is, and how much it matters that Accenture has a good security culture. The fourth point might be summarized as easy come, easy go. One of the ironies of advancements in computing is that the very same technology that makes life so convenient for all of us makes it convenient for hackers and criminals too. A year or so ago, when I was on vacation with my family in Washington, D.C., we visited the Spy Museum. I highly recommend it if you're ever there. They have an amazing collection of spying devices. My favorite were the bugs that manipulated themselves into position so they could overhear conversations and transmit them back. One was placed inside a concrete building block and was designed to drill its way out when the block had already been installed into the wall of an embassy building. Another was designed to open up a little umbrella that would get caught in the flow of liquid in a sewer, dragging a fine wire that could be connected to downstream so that the bug inside an embassy would be connected by wire through the sewer to a recorder several hundred yards away. Anyway, that was a digression. Back to hackers and criminals. What reminded me of the Spy Museum was those little Cold War-era cameras that spies used to use to photograph secret documents. Just think how long it would have taken Bradley Manning to photograph those 260,000 diplomatic cables. Instead, all he had to do was copy them onto CDs. A single music CD holds about 700 megabytes of data. WikiLeaks put on its website an encrypted file with the file name Insurance that people thought was an archive containing the entire collection of cables, which under this theory they were threatening to release if WikiLeaks were attacked. This file was only 1.3 gigabytes in size. That would mean that the entire corpus of diplomatic cables would fit on only two CDs. The capacity of storage devices, how many bytes you get per dollar, has grown over the last few decades at roughly the same rate as Moore's Law, which predicts the exponential growth in the number of transistors on a chip. Images, videos, and sound recordings will take up a lot of the space we have available, and text will take a smaller and smaller proportion. Andrew Tannenbaum, a Dutch computer scientist, estimated in a talk that I heard him give that if the disks on laptops continue to grow at their current rate, there'll be enough room in 20 years to store the entire library of human knowledge expressed in text on a single machine. And finally, a fifth point, one of the crucial technical deficiencies of the centralized database was that it didn't track who was accessing material in the database. Protecting access to information is only half the story. From a security perspective, auditing is often just as important as access control. Because no access control system is perfect, so it's essential to know what happened with the data. Moreover, because audit logs allow people to be punished for illegal behavior, auditing is a crucial deterrent in preventing attacks in the first place. It seems likely that Bradley Manning would never have leaked the cables if he had known that he would have been caught. So in summary, the cable leaks episode wasn't that remarkable from a technical perspective. It reminds us of five basic but important facts. First, the dangers of aggregating data and the need to compartmentalize it so that access is granted only to those with a need to know. Second, the importance of physical security. That's why in the Accenture training, we're reminded of how critical it is to be careful about leaving laptops and PDAs in vulnerable places. Third, the role of a security culture, and that technology is only as good as the people who maintain, administer, and use it. Fourth, the irony that technological advances have made life easier for us all, including criminals. And fifth, the importance of auditing in addition to access control. In combination with this podcast, I'm posting a blog article with some links to some relevant sites, including in particular one that reproduces the instant messaging logs in which Bradley Manning explains how he obtained the cables and transmitted them to WikiLeaks. Do post your comments and ideas. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Goodbye.
Copyright 2010, Daniel Jackson. Music copyright 2010, Chris Bremer from pianosociety.com.